Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
From the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're going to hear about the Laredo Border Patrol serial killer in a moment, but first, according to the Customs and Border Patrol, there were 186 alleged incidents of sexual harassment, sexual assault, rape, and/or sexual discrimination committed by or perpetrated against Border Patrol agents between 2000 and 2022. Getting public information about crimes committed by Border Patrol agents is next to impossible. Investigative journalist Aaron Siegel McIntyre writes about that in the current issue of Mother Jones. Her article is Crossing the Line, the Border Patrol's Culture of Impunity Enables Bad Behavior and Sometimes Keeps It from the Public View.
This piece sort of looks at systemic problems within the Border Patrol that correspond to transparency, discipline, disclosure of problems, and essentially how misconduct complaints are investigated internally and what the public knows about some problems that many would consider pretty serious. The magazine piece looks at one case in particular that has never been brought to the public before, and it explains why.
And tell me more about that case.
Sure. Yeah. So when I set out to do this piece, you know, I've been doing research and reporting on the Border Patrol for about a decade. I'm working on a long-term book project, and it looks at accountability and the culture of the agency, the institutional culture, and the connections between that workplace culture and misconduct reporting, accountability, corruption issues that we see come to light when sort of the worst happens, and why that is. And so, you know, instead of looking at any one incident, I tend to try to identify patterns and look at systemic processes. You know, it's not just a bad apple kind of situation when misconduct occurs. A lot of the time, it can be sort of a consequence of kind of cultural aversion to reporting, a cultural aversion to, you know, having discipline serve as a deterrent versus, you know, treating wrongdoing as, hey, it's my buddy, let's just keep things in house and just keep going. And so when I set out to think about, okay, so what narrative or what single case is worthy of some attention? what could kind of float a conversation about these bigger issues? I filed a number of different public records requests to CPB, the parent agency of the Border Patrol, to local law enforcement, in this case, to the Artesia Police Department over in Artesia, New Mexico, which is where the Border Patrol Academy is based. It's where trainees are trained, where they become agents, probationary agents. And I also filed requests to a bunch of other places, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Campus, which is, you know, an arm of the DHS. It's where the Border Patrol Academy is. It's that campus. They have their own sort of investigative body and their own FOIA reporting, public information reporting. And I collected a whole bunch of interviews with current former agents and collected a bunch of old press clips and court documents, documents around judicial proceedings related to Border Patrol agents, both current and former, and sort of through that mountain of information began to sift. And so I came across this single case, which is a reported rape case that came into the 911 dispatcher over in Artesia, New Mexico, back in September 2019. And this case was called in by a supervisor, Mr. Claflin, Border Patrol agent at the academy, who reported that an instructor had allegedly raped a trainee, a young woman. And so because that document existed, because that 911 call record existed, from there, I was able to sort of chase down what happened.
Now, the Border Patrol goes through these spurts of hiring. The Congress will say, we want you to hire X number of thousand more agents, and then they have to hire them pretty quickly. Do they sometimes lower their standards in order to meet these goals? And does that result in some people who otherwise wouldn't be a Border Patrol agent become a Border Patrol agent and then possibly commit crimes?
So hiring and recruitment is a big part of this puzzle, Dave. That's exactly what matters here. I don't know if we want to use the word lowering standards. That feels too much like an opinion. But what is absolutely true over time, and it continues today, is that the standards tend to fluctuate. So if we look back to when the Border Patrol was sort of reorganized back to the year 2003, when the Department of Homeland Security was first established after 9/11. That's when the Border Patrol's mission shifted a little bit. The lens of national security and securing the border, that's what the mission was seen through. And so, you know, back then, President Bush did create this mandate for hiring in which a surge of new agents would be hired. And in order to do that, yeah, the standards were tweaked. Some say they were dropped. And we saw the consequences of that shift play out over the next 15 years or so, when we would see, you know, agents committing crimes, agents working for drug cartels, agents involved in, you know, hitman type situations, drug smuggling, some of the very worst crimes that could be committed by a federal agent who was supposed to be serving the purpose of national security, right? And so the argument can certainly be made that some of these kind of bad actors shouldn't have been hired in the first place. When we look at crimes that have committed more recently by agents, like let's look at, you know, Arizona, for example, and Tucson sector, you know, in the past couple of years, we've seen the cases, high profile cases of agents, former agents at this point, like Stephen Charles Holmes or Dana Thornhill, that have been convicted and sentenced for sex crimes, some involving children in the case of Thornhill. And, you know, Thornhill in particular, you know, he had a record that went back to being a teenager when he first committed sex crimes against other minors. And so, you know, you could make the case that, hey, is that guy the kind of guy we want representing the Border Patrol, being a federal agent? You know, there are a lot of questions there. And then in more recent history, if we look at the Trump administration, you know, Trump was hired and he pretty quickly made a call for adding 5,000 more Border Patrol agents to our force. And at that time, back in 2017, 2018, you know, the agency was already struggling with both recruiting and retaining agents. And so when we look at what happened under Trump, did they meet that quota, even though they did again tweak those hiring protocols? No, they failed. They aren't even able to meet the quotas that were existing before Trump expanded that boots on the ground call. And so, yeah, when we look at hiring, it's crucially important, and it does have a consequence down the line. If we drop our standards, it results in more crimes being committed.
I've been covering the border for multiple decades, trying to get quotes from the Border Patrol about what's going on is frequently very difficult.
You know, reporters are in such a hard place when it comes to reporting on the Border Patrol, and it's because they're so good at being opaque, right? If you even ask for the most simple public records request or the most simple question for headquarters to answer, a lot of the time they'll give you a statement on background, and it's the same statement they use again and again whenever misconduct pops up, right? They'll say, hey, we take all the allegations very seriously and we investigate them fully. Now, okay, that may be true, but it also doesn't give us information about any given case.
Erin Siegel McIntyre is an investigative reporter. Her latest article is Crossing the Line: The Border Patrol's culture of impunity enables bad behavior and sometimes keeps it from the public view. It's in the current issue of Mother Jones. When we come back from the break, when a Border Patrol agent turns serial killer in the streets
of Laredo.
Support
for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Laredo is a fast-growing border community, critical for international trade. The gateway city has seen fortunes won and lost with the rise and fall of the peso and the price of natural gas. It can be a rough town and it can get really dark there. And that's the Laredo that we see in the book, The Devil Behind the Badge, to horrifying 12 Days of the Border Patrol's serial killer. We're joined by the author of the book, Rick Drivis, and he is a Pulitzer Prize recognized reporter. And Rick, welcome to The Source. And Rick, so when you started working on this book, how familiar were you with Laredo? Because we get a very detailed look at Laredo, as especially the gritty side.
Hey there.
Hey, Rick, I understand we are now connected. Are you there?
I'm here, yes.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. Don't apologize. We'll just blame it on the gremlins. So, Rick, the book, The Devil Behind the Badge, you know, the horrifying 12 days of the Border Patrol serial killer happening in Laredo. How familiar were you with Laredo when you began to report on the story? The book is very detailed, and we get a close-up look at Laredo's gritty side.
So I actually was fairly familiar with Laredo prior to all of this happening. I have been working for USA Today for close to 20 years now, and 6 or 7 of those years, I've been based in Austin and really focusing on covering the actual border. So I have been down to sort of Laredo several times, as well as Brownsville, McAllen, Eagle Pass, a lot of the border cities around there. And I have been to like Laredo, but I had never really discovered this other side to sort of Laredo before, this kind of underbelly that it had. And so that was the part of Laredo that I really needed to sort of dig into, and that's where my sort of reporting led me to.
And so when we say underbelly, we're talking about the world of sex workers, and also drug use happening. You know, there's overlap there with some of the sex workers, and poverty, despair. In the streets of Laredo, is that it?
That's correct. And I should preface this by saying that Laredo, as well as almost all of the other border towns along the border in Texas, are actually extremely safe. Like I have never felt, you know, personally threatened there. I have never felt that there was a very obvious criminal element. This is more of a part of Laredo that I had a sort of glimpse at, and it's really concentrated around one street down in Laredo called San Bernardo Avenue. And San Bernardo is kind of known as sort of Laredo's sort of like red light district, and that's where, you know, a lot of the sex workers congregate. That's where a lot of the drug houses are, and that's where I focus a lot of my actual attention.
So a lot of cheap hotels and fast food outlets right there.
Correct. Yeah, it's basically lined with a lot of these sort of cheaper motels, the actual Relax Inn, La Loma Alta, Pan American Courts, and these are all like motels that a lot of these sex workers congregate at. It's where they stay at. It's where they actually conduct a lot of their business in.
You go out of your way in your reporting in this book to humanize the sex workers in an incredible way, telling their stories, showing that they had families and loved ones, that they were more than just sex workers.
David, really, that was a driving force behind this book, really. When I first started covering this, I basically covered it for like USA Today. I went down there just to cover it as a story. And initially, from the press conference and some of the early sort of media reports, there was a sense of, you know, these were sex workers, and so they sort of put themselves like into this sort of position where bad things happen. But the more that I got to know some of their families, the more and more open some of their families became with me, a sort of different picture started to emerge, and I quickly realized that they were all like beloved, first of all, like all the families really, really cared for all these women, and that they were mothers, and they were sisters, and they were all daughters and siblings, and there was people out there who really, really cared for them, and all of their families didn't didn't actually give up on them until the very end. All of them wanted them off of the streets. All of them wanted to help them with different substance abuse disorders that all of them had. And so I started to gain a picture of slightly different people than how they were sort of originally portrayed. And that really was a driving force. I was really driven to tell their stories above everything else.
I'd like to ask you how you got that element. That must have been really difficult to obtain. But first, I just want to highlight how these families were wrecked when their loved ones were discovered to be murder victims.
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy. You're basically approaching people during some of the lowest points in their lives, and you're asking them to like open up and talk about these women who were all troubled, who were all marginalized. I think part of it is that they kept seeing me down there. Like I had to take more than 25, 30 trips down to Laredo, and I would attend all these pre-trial hearings for the suspect at the time. And so they kept seeing me in pre-trial hearings. They would see me around town, and slowly they started to gain confidence and started to open up to me. But it's really hard, you know, it's basically hard. And one thing which all of them did, which was really admirable, is that they spoke about all of these women with love and admiration, but also with a real sense of honesty and sort of genuineness. Like they were perfectly honest about all of their faults and their struggles and all of their challenges. And so I really commended them for opening up to me and doing it in a very genuine way.
Do you have a caller on the line? The number is 833-877-8255. And Henrietta, you're on the air. Henrietta, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And I'm glad that he wrote this book, because there's good and bad in everything. But one of the most important things is my son. I'm proud of him. He served this country for 27 and a half years as a federal agent. And it's kind of hard to say Border Patrol, because they don't have a good picture of the Border Patrol, even though they're great. There's a lot of great officers, but most of all, thanks to for my daughter-in-law, because she stood with him, she stood strong, and she's a wonderful woman. But my son is a very super religious person, but I'm glad he served our country.
Henrietta, thank you so much. There are about 17,000 Border Patrol agents on the U.S.-Mexico border. The overwhelming, you know, vast majority of them are not serial killers. They follow the law. They're ethical. But there are some that need to be checked up on, Rick.
Yeah, and that's sort of a common sort of refrain. If you talk with Border Patrol officials or CBP officials, they're quick to like point out that these are a handful of agents committing these really heinous crimes, and that it doesn't represent the more than 20,000 agents that were on the force like at the time of this event. But you know, there were other instances in this sector in the same year. There was another Border Patrol agent who was arrested and tried for murdering his girlfriend and their 10-month-old son. There was another agent who was like investigated for shooting a migrant and killing her on the job. And that's only in the sort of Laredo sector. And granted, these definitely aren't sort of representative of all the agents out there. Like, you're right, David. I have also interacted with a lot of agents out there who are hardworking, who are upstanding and straight-laced. But there are agents within there that need to be investigated. And your previous guest, Aaron, actually highlighted some of the difficulties, some of the challenges of learning how CBP disciplines its own agents. I think if you talk to immigrant advocates out there, one of their top sort of complaints is not the wrongdoing, it's the transparency. It's that they have very little idea how the agency is actually going about disciplining some of these agents, and that the agency needs to be a lot more transparent with that.
Right, and there's a lot of issues, questions about corruption inside the Border Patrol and about how they keep an eye on and discipline of their own agents when there are problems, and how much the public should be allowed to know about these issues. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. We'll continue our discussion talking about the Border Patrol serial killer of Laredo. We're going to hear more about the man who was found guilty for that, Juan David Ortiz. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Juan David Ortiz received an automatic life sentence in prison when he was convicted of the killing of four sex workers in Laredo in 2018. It was a capital murder trial, but he did not get the death penalty. But this is the district attorney of Webb County said it was because the victim's families had asked for that. But he told the jurors, the jurors heard recordings of him, David Ortiz, saying he wanted to clean up the streets of Laredo. We're speaking with Rick Jervis. He is the author of the book, The Devil Behind the Badge, The Horrible 12 Days of the Border Patrol Serial Killer. And so, Rick Jervis, do you know that? Did the families really request no death penalty for Ortiz?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting part of the book, I think, is a sort of evolution of the families. You know, when I first started covering this back in 2018, a lot of them were fairly split, basically between those who wanted the death penalty and those who didn't. Laredo, like many border communities, are strongly Catholic, strongly religious. Some of them didn't really believe in the actual death penalty. So they were fairly split and as the years ticked off and as the trial was basically delayed year after year, they're thinking and that kind of evolved. But there's a very pivotal moment that's in the book. It's actually one of my favorite parts in the book, where Joey Cantu, who is the older brother of one of the victims, Shelley Cantu, stands up like in the middle of this meeting between the district attorney and the other families. This is shortly after one of the pretrial hearings where the district attorney Alanese is basically talking to them and asking them whether they want to actually pursue the death penalty or just life in prison. And Joey stands up and gives this really impassioned speech. He had been in prison himself for 25 years. He went in as a 15-year-old kind of gangbanger. He was convicted as an adult, and he spent a lot of hard time in like Texas prisons. He incidentally was basically released early for good behavior in 2018, just a couple of months, like right before his sister was killed. But he stands up in this conference room and tells everybody that he's been in prison before, that he basically knows how it is, and he gives these details of other inmates like just starting to go insane and losing their mind and just being in really bad places. And he basically describes just how hard it is. And he tells them that he would rather see Juan David Ortiz spend the rest of his life in prison than get the death penalty, that he basically considers the death penalty the sort of easy way out. And like at the end of this very sort of emotional meeting, almost everybody's like in tears. They all basically decide that they want to pursue life in prison for like Ortiz rather than death penalty.
So life in prison is a fate worse than death in his view.
What an enjoy. Yeah, that's how he saw it. And there's other layers to him too. He's a very interesting character. He has an evolution that he ends up essentially forgiving Ortiz for what he did. He says later that he hates the crime, but not the criminal. And so he basically convinces everybody else that life in prison is better than the death penalty.
The number to call in if you get a question or comment about this Border Patrol serial killer. Were you following this? Were you living in Laredo at the time? What was it like during these 12 days as it became known in Laredo that there was a serial killer on the loose? The number to call in is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So you do also give us an evolution of Juan David Ortiz, and he starts off as an evangelical, Bible-loving young man, goes off, serves in the military. He eventually finds his way into the Border Patrol. He is a model agent, sees himself as an advocate for migrants. Then he takes a turn PTSD becomes more and more pronounced in him, and he embraces Donald Trump and the call to deport them all and becomes a hardcore individual in that way. Tell us about that arc. You know, why did things go so badly for him? Was it the PTSD and the pharmaceuticals that they gave him?
Yeah, I tried to dig into his past as much as possible. I was really interested where this all took such a bad turn, right? Because everything that I discovered about his early life was that he was a good kid. He was a good student, just like you mentioned. He was very religious. He led the Bible study group at his high school. And there weren't any red flags, as far as anybody can tell. Nothing that was out of line. So things really start to take a turn, it seems, after he moves to Laredo in 2017. I think one of the first key things that happened is that he's basically assigned to this unit called the Tactical Enforcement Unit. And this is a part of Border Patrol, which is tasked with raiding stash houses and breaking up criminal rings and being really sort of proactive and trying to break down cartel activity on the U.S. side. And as part of the Tactical Enforcement Unit, he gets to know intimately where all these drug houses are. He gets to see and actually know some of the sex workers attached to that area. So the Tactical Enforcement Unit gives him his first introduction into life on San Bernardo Avenue, which I mentioned earlier. The other thing is in February 2018, is when things really start to sort of deteriorate for him. He complains to friends and other military buddies that he's under a lot of pressure, like at work. He starts complaining about having nightmares and anxiety, even like paranoia. One of his friends basically recommends going to the local VA clinic there, which he does. And the VA clinic basically prescribes this kind of cocktail of psychotropic medication. And he starts to take these 5, 6, 7 pills every day, but he's also mixing them with beer and alcohol. And he's mixing a lot of these things together. And colleagues and friends that I spoke to told me that they really start to see him visibly decline. And he's not only complaining about having paranoia thoughts, he's also bragging to colleagues that he basically knows where some of the sex workers live, and he's bragging about picking up women on his off time that's not his wife.
Also, some of the grim activities or whatever the duties, seen dead bodies in the desert, dead bodies in the river, all these things reminds him of when he was in the war.
Yeah, he had a really good friend of his, Eric Aguilar, who was friends of him when he was stationed back at 29 Palms in California, and was with him too when they were basically deployed to Baghdad. And he's complaining to Eric that he's seeing, you know, a lot of migrants along the border, that he's seeing bodies also, and he's complaining to him, but he's also sending him sort of disturbing messages, not just about the work overload, but his tone starts to change, whereas sort of before he was telling neighbors and friends that he wanted to sort of protect migrants. Now he's sending messages saying that he just wants to deport them all. And he sends his friend a photo of Donald Trump with the caption, "Deporter in chief." And he basically tells his friend that he just wants them all deported, that he doesn't feel like any of them should have a shot at the U.S.
Ortiz told investigators that he had been accustomed of most of the women that were killed. He also expressed disdain for sex workers and drug users, referring to them as trash and so dirty, insisting that he wanted to clean up the streets. And he said that the monster would come out of him as he drove along the stretch of the street in Laredo San Bernardo, frequented by the women. So something happened to him. The question needs to be, you know, is this an isolated one bad apple, or are we setting up people to fail? I mean, he could be the extreme case, but, you know, putting men and women in the Border Patrol, telling them to go to places like Laredo up and down the U.S.-Mexico border, subjecting them to extreme stress, extreme work hours, long periods of boredom, and then met with extreme times of hyperactivity. Is that a recipe for putting people through too much? So let's talk about that when we come back from the break. And JD, I'm going to get you on the air when we come right back. This is the number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. It's The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Rick Jervis is with us. He is has been recognized with the Pulitzer Prize, and he is also the author of the book, The Devil Behind the Badge, The Horrifying 12 Days of the Border Patrol Serial Killer, which happened in Laredo in 2018. Let's go to a caller. The number is 833-877-8255. And JD, you're on the air. JD, go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to clarify a little bit of what Mr. Cantu said about prison being so bad. It's not that bad. I mean, I was a correctional officer, and I worked just about everywhere inside the prison, including segregation. And that's where you keep the worst inmates.
All right, JD, thank you for the call. When you're there for life in prison, as you get older, we've seen that the men, as their bodies break down, they don't get support, medical support. It becomes, quite bad. There should be some compassionate release for these people, but that's not the case. But let's get back on track here, talking about the book. So, Rick, when did Laredo realize that they had a serial killer on their hands?
So this happened
probably after the second victim emerged, Claudine Lueda. She was found like on the side of the road, not far from where the first victim, Melissa Ramirez, was actually found. She was picked up, and interestingly, different from the other three victims was that she was still alive. She had been shot in the head multiple times, and somehow was still clinging to like life barely. And so she was driven off like in an ambulance, and like at the time, the people since there weren't any obvious gunshot wounds at the time, the investigators early on when they first arrived to the scene thought possibly that this was what is known as an auto ped or an auto pedestrian accident, whereas a sort of person just kind of drifts off into the middle of a highway, and one of the many trucks around there comes and hits them, and so they thought it was just like a hit and run. But when they get to the hospital, one of the doctors tells one of the sheriff's deputies there that they did X-rays and that it basically wasn't an auto ped, that she had been shot, that there were gunshot wounds. And then investigators back at the scene also found that there were shell casings there also, and not just shell casings, but 40 caliber shell casings of this one sort of particular brand called Federal. And those were the same caliber, same brand used with the first victim. More so, there were they were able to quickly identify the second victim as Claudine Huerta, and they basically knew already that Claudine was actually friends with the first victim. In fact, they were looking for Claudine to talk to her to like try to get more sort of information about like Melissa. And so once they realized that these both that both of these women, just a couple miles apart, had each been shot with 40 caliber federal bullets, they basically realized at that point that they had a serial killer on their hands.
You look at the what's happening with Border Patrol agents, and it's very difficult to try and get a wide view of what's happening with the attitudes and the vibe in the Border Patrol. But you report on the I'm 1015 Facebook page. What is that, and what did that tell you about attitudes in the Border Patrol about serving in places like Laredo?
I'm 1015 Facebook page
was something that came up, and it basically was only discovered because different media outlets like The Intercept found out about it, wrote about it, and basically publicized it. And these were Facebook pages that was members only, just to like Border Patrol agents. And these agents would like go to the page and basically post a lot of sort of misogynist messages and things and posts that were not very kind to migrants and to different members of Congress even. It created a big stir once it was publicized, and there were like congressional investigations into it. But even after all of that came out, even after it basically was investigated, only two of the agents were actually removed from their jobs. And so immigrant advocates point to that as yet another example of the agency basically more interested in like protecting its agent rather than actually disciplining them.
Eventually, the suspect one, David Ortiz, is caught, but it's almost by accident. Can you talk about, you know, what led to his apprehension?
So Juan David Ortiz, 12 days after killing his first victim, pulls a gun on a would-be fifth victim, Erica Pena. And Erica Pena, similar to the other women, was also a sex worker who actually frequented San Bernardo Avenue also. And Ortiz pulls a gun on her, inside of his truck. And Erica Pena is somehow able to, and he's pointing a gun at her with one hand and is holding her by her blouse with his other hand. He's actually left-handed, so he has a gun in his left hand and is holding her with his right hand. And Erica somehow, just something snaps in her, and she's able to wrestle out of her blouse, kicks the door open, and runs off shirtless into the night. They basically happen to be parked right behind this gas station. And so Erica comes running in to the gas station, and a Texas State Trooper happens to be pumping gas right at the same station. So she runs right up to him, tells him everything which had happened. And David Ortiz drives off. And so this is the sort of start of a manhunt for Juan David Ortiz, which is kind of involved. It takes them basically driving Erica Pena roughly to his house. She's able to basically identify the house. Through the address, they're able to basically identify him, and then they launch a manhunt for him that eventually catches up with him.
The idea that the sex workers would be involved with law enforcement, if you didn't know the area, if you didn't know the situation, that would seem odd to you, but actually shouldn't be surprising or uncommon, as you write in the book, particularly in places like Laredo. And I've heard about this also in Eagle Pass, where you have all these troopers, National Guardsmen there for long periods of time. It seems to be a thing.
Yeah, I actually spoke to a number of sex workers, some of them on the record, some of them just on background. But I talked to like a number of them, like Don Laredo, who told me that it's not uncommon for them to have clients that are not only Border Patrol agents, but, you know, sheriff's deputies, DEA agents down there. So people like in uniform are clients of theirs down there, and it's like not uncommon. So when David Ortiz started to pick up some of these women, and he had definitely been with Erica Pena before, they had a relationship. He also possibly knew Melissa Ramirez, the first victim. So when he starts to pick them up and starts to have sort of relations with them, it's not a big deal. People there, like on the board, the avenue didn't think twice about that.
What would have happened if he had not been caught? If Juan David Ortiz had not been caught at that time? If Erica had not managed to slip out of his grasp and alert the police, do you think he would have continued to kill?
So Juan David Ortiz
gave a very detailed interview to like investigators after he was arrested, and he very clearly states in that interview that he basically intended to continue killing, that at that point he saw himself somewhat as a sort of vigilante, and that he wanted to basically keep actually returning to San Bernardo Avenue killing sex workers. He also had a vision of suicide. Also, he also told investigators that he planned to either kill himself or die, you know, by like the hands of sort of law enforcement later. But he definitely planned on continuing to kill even after his final victim was murdered.
Briefly, as we finish out of the Border Patrol, did they give you much assistance in working on this book?
The short answer is no. I asked them for any type of comment. I filed several FOIA requests, none of which were actually answered, and they just kept telling me that the case was still under investigation, despite the fact that he had been arrested, convicted, and sentenced already.
And he lost his appeal. Rick Jervis is the author of the book, The Devil Behind the Badge, The Horrifying 12 Days of the Border Patrol Serial Killer, charting what happened down in Laredo in 2018. Ricky, thank you so much for bearing with us. We appreciate your support and listening to us and talking to us today. Thank you so much.
David, thank you.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.